In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
South Dakota boasts a vibrant food culture from farm to fork, but not everyone has a seat at the table. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, July 22nd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, federal cuts to Feeding South Dakota have pinched the organization's ability to deliver enough food to more than 100,000 South Dakotans in need. We'll talk about what the benchmarks might be for creating a more sustainable food system. Meanwhile, the amount of food wasted in this country equals around 2% of America's GDP. We'll look at efforts to pick up extra food from restaurants and grocery stores and deliver that food where it is needed most. Plus, bringing the farm to the classroom with the help of dozens of the state's youngest gardeners. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The food insecurity rate in South Dakota hovers above 12%, and that means more than 100,000 South Dakotans live amongst the abundance of our farms and fields and yet do not have reliable access to nutritious food. We're going to look at this from a few different angles today. We will learn about food distribution across the state. In rural South Dakota, increasingly it is families with working parents and grandparents who are standing in line, asking for help with putting foods in their cupboards and on their tables. We'll also zoom in on food waste by exploring a program that takes extra prepared food from urban restaurants and grocery stores and delivers it to nonprofit organizations that feed people. And later in the hour, we will dig our hands in the soil at an urban farm where one of the goals is to help school kids get dirty growing their own food so everyone can eat. Let's start with Feeding South Dakota and Bread Break. Lori Dykstra is CEO of Feeding South Dakota. That's a program with a 50-year legacy in the state. Pam Cole is executive director of Bread Break, a program with the mission of food recovery to reduce food waste. Lori, 50 years of Feeding South Dakota. Tell us a little bit about what your organization does and how it has evolved over time. Because 50 years is a long time.
Yeah, it is. 50 years is a long time. So we started out as a food pantry and through the Sioux Falls Ministerial Association right here in Sioux Falls, and eventually became what we're known now as Feeding South Dakota over the years, evolving from what a food pantry is to a food bank. And the food bank is really a distribution center where lots of food comes in, and you can think of us as the wholesaler, and we get it out to a lot of partners. We serve all 66 counties in the state, and we have three distribution centers, one in Sioux Falls, one in Rapid City, and one in Pierre. And one of the things that has evolved the most over the years, especially post-pandemic, is the increased need of services, especially in our rural communities where they lack resources.
Mm. And that's increasing over the last 50 years, over the last time that you've been CEO.
Yeah, it's continuously increased since I've been CEO, but also it's the highest percentage of food insecurity rates that we've ever seen in the state of South Dakota in our 50 years.
Help us understand what food insecurity is. How do you define it?
Yeah, food insecurity is the lack of access to nutritious foods to really thrive.
Yeah, right. Do you have an idea of why?
You know, I could speculate, but I am certainly not an economics major. But I will say that, we hear from our families, and it's working families in our lines, that they're stretching their dollars, housing, daycare shortages. And while we have a low unemployment rate in some of our cities, it's hard to find unemployment when you're in a very rural community like Wagner, South Dakota, Kimball, South Dakota, on a reservation. There's just a lack of jobs in some of those areas. So lack of job, lack of resources just creates problems for families.
All right. Pam Cole, tell us a little bit about Bread Break.
Bread Break started as an idea, like a lot of nonprofits do. In 2011, a couple, the Baumans in Messiah New Hope Lutheran Church, decided they wanted to do something about food being wasted at food businesses. So they went to Kentucky Fried Chicken and picked up, the frozen chicken from the day before and then started bringing that to places like the Veterans Service Center, St. Francis House. And then it just blossomed into this wonderful in-church volunteer led program for 10 years. And then ultimately 4 years ago now, I guess, in June of 2021, they formed a board and filed for and received 501c3 funding. Then last fall in 2024, they kept growing and they had enough funds put together that they decided to have a strategic plan in which they interviewed and hired me as executive director. So, you know, as we sit here and talk about food insecurity and food waste, we're very focused on food waste. 2% of our GDP in the United States, upwards of $500 billion a year, is food that could have been eaten. So our focus and our mission is rerouting that food, those food overages from businesses to agencies that serve those in need that, you know, have the food distribution.
So in some countries, that food waste that equals 2% of the GDP, you would look at storage. But for us, that food waste is largely happening like the consumer or restaurant or grocery store level. It's not rotting in a warehouse, in other words. It's ending up in the dumpster. Help us understand how food waste looks. What does that look like in America?
Locally here, it looks like about 15 million pounds of edible food, up to 30 million pounds here in our regional landfill of food that's peelings, et cetera, that can be composted.
Okay.
But yeah, food that could have been used, yeah, that's 10 to 15 million pounds here. So last year, Bread Break rerouted 300,000 pounds of that food to over 40 different agencies that serve those in need. And in fact, we love that we partner very closely with Feeding South Dakota because Quickstar is one that we go to through them and then bring to probably 30 different agencies through the week. We have 6 or 7 routes every day that we go to 5 different Quickstars. And that's just, you know, a small piece of what we do. So we currently have over 50 volunteer drivers at driving over 70 routes at this point, 7 days a week, bringing all this, you know, usable, wonderful food of variety of forms to all the agencies in town that serve the homeless, serve veterans, serve the you know, people that have come out of incarceration that are getting back on their feet. So it's an opportunity amidst, you know, really challenging time to know that we have all this food waste. Let's kind of bring that and equalize it a little bit more. So there, we could barely touch the surface. So it is a light in the darkness to be able to know that we could even do a lot more food recovery here in Sioux Falls and then take our model elsewhere around the state over time.
Yeah, a little portability there. Lori, let's talk a little bit about some of the pressures that you're seeing right now. Back in March, there was a cut from the White House. Tell us a little bit about that and how quickly you saw the impact of that.
Back in March, President Trump signed a executive order to cut the $500 million in CCC funding. That's Commodity Credit Corporation funding that he put in his first term. And when they took that funding away, some of those dollars are used to go to the USDA for the USDA to purchase food from producers across the country. Producers, they're receiving food like ground beef, milk, eggs, really good healthy things, and that food goes to food banks. So we rely on it. And so when that happened, we immediately lost access to 1.5 million pounds of food for this next fiscal year.
Wow.
In order to replace that, it would cost our food bank $2.3 million. So while you talk about policy changes and things that happen at a federal level, it can take sort of a year or so to take effect. This was immediate. The DOGE cuts and the executive order cuts were immediate. So as a nonprofit, we were told this funding was cut, and within 3 weeks we saw loads cut, and we lost immediately about $300,000 in food in that first 3 weeks. And that will be equivalent of $2.3 million over the next year. So we had to make difficult decisions internally. We didn't want to make that all we didn't want all those cuts to go directly to the guests we serve. So we made difficult decisions internally to cut about $750,000 out of our own budget, just things that we need in our building and need, mm-hmm. but needed, we just had to cut at this time. And then we also had to reduce our food distributions and our mobile distributions.
So tell me a little bit about, you know, you said this is a program that President Trump added in during his first administration. What was before then? Because the argument here is that this president would have added it because there was a disruption in everything during the pandemic. And now, 5 years after the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, we should be back to some kind of economic normal. Help us put this into context then with what he was adding and now taking away and how that fits in the big picture on either side of those historic moments.
Yeah, a couple things happened. So yes, that met a need during that time and that moment in time. But what happened post-COVID is when we were talking about systems coming back together, but businesses made really smart decisions during COVID, good business decisions for them, to not stock their shelves to excess in the same way that they did pre-pandemic. So part of the way we get food, similar to Bread Break, is we get food recovery as well. We get it from the Sam's Clubs, the Costco's, the Hy-Vee's, the Walmart's, multiple stores, Quickstar, mm-hmm. and we receive those overages. Well, now they're not stocking to excess, which is, I can understand as a business owner, is a smart decision. They don't want to have waste. But that, what would normally go into the landfill, which we don't want, would go to food banks, and it was still edible food. It was still, there was still a shelf life on it, and we lost a huge portion. In fact, in the first year post-pandemic, it was down about 50%. Now it's starting to come up a little bit. They're starting to bring that up, but it hasn't come back to pre-pandemic. So that's part of the issue. Mm-hmm. So donated product from food stores and things that have overages and the Kellogg's of the world is down. So that's one part. The other part is that we're starting to see more working families in our line. I don't know exactly, again, why that is, but we have families who went back to work and they're just struggling to get by, and they're in our food line for what we call supplemental food to get them through the month. And then lastly, we're very rural. So the resources and things that we have in Sioux Falls, I tell people we can get a hot meal on any given day in Sioux Falls or Rapid City, but you go in a rural community, they may get our food truck 1 hour a month. Those same families have to travel for work, have to travel for food, any kind of resources that they need. And so they're struggling, and that's probably one of the hardest hit areas for us.
Yeah. Pam, have you seen cuts or changes to funding recently with this administration? How has that intersected with the work that you do?
Yeah, so we're a lot different. So with Feeding South Dakota, they have the food overage at that warehouse level, that larger level. And we see that, you know, weekly overage at food producers that are food businesses, restaurants, convenience stores. And we're moving into areas with event and corporate food. Sure. So catered. So we're rescuing those with the Chambers doing that. Canopy by Hilton's doing that. Sanford and both Avera. And we'll reach out to a lot more caterers. And then fresh produce with local producers. We're going to do a push to make sure that they're not throwing things away that they could get to us. But with the, it's really counterintuitive when we look at our government as how they're, you know, maybe not helping to purchase a wholesale kind of concept from, you know, wheat producers, dairies, and fresh produce that, you know, can keep up our agricultural processes in the United States, because we overproduce in many areas, and then getting that to the markets and so on. I don't think they're looking ahead at the federal level to see how they really could get and work directly with producers. I grew up on a family farm right by Canada in North Dakota, and we basically grew, you know, wheat was our biggest thing that we produced, as well as canola and beans and other things. So I'm not sure if all of these executive orders and cuts are going to be a friend to the farmer ultimately, as we look at our producers. And there would be a way that, you know, through the Farm Bill, through others, that helping to provide those wholesale funding mechanisms for the Feeding South Dakotas, Feeding America, and then ultimately it trickles down to our people. that would be a win-win-win, I think. So, you know, solution-oriented is what we're trying to do to look at food waste as a major problem in the United States and in South Dakota, and then that food recovery starts to balance it out. But ultimately, and Lori knows this, that we have to visit with our leaders as well on what can we do together to reframe this and look at our food systems in the United States. It's a movement right now to food recovery is enormous because we know it's such a huge waste. What couldn't we do with upwards of $500 billion? Mm-hmm. And after all the food's gone through the entire system of growing it, moving it, preparing it, producing it to something else, bringing it to market, and then we throw it away, 35%. So there's bigger things here that, you know, we really need to probably visit with leadership on some of this. We are now to this point with the United States where, food insecurity, people not knowing where to go get food, the overproduction of food, it's like this imbalance of having so much in the consumerism aspect and making too much food, but then at the same time having one out of six on average people not necessarily knowing where their next meal is coming from or what their food plan. So we're back to, you know, looking for food. Mm-hmm. People are spending their time trying to figure out how to get enough to eat. And if they could use some of that energy toward applying for jobs, which they still try to do, we see that, and then working at jobs. So this imbalance doesn't work for our society, and it's not that person's fault. It's not that family's fault. It is the fault of what is our system doing to make this situation better and can work for the middle class that's shrinking. You know, we're seeing some of that with it just costs so much more to rent, to buy food. Food's really expensive.
Yeah, I want to go back to Lori Dykstra here with Feeding South Dakota for a minute and just ask you about SNAP benefits. And, you know, how does that intersect with the work that you do at Feeding South Dakota to help us understand that?
Yeah, you know, I always say SNAP gets people out of our food line.
Okay.
So food banks fill in where SNAP doesn't cover. So we're filling those gaps. So to me, I would much rather a family member have access to SNAP where they can go in and purchase the food that their family will eat so we don't have waste. They're not just getting what they get, right? They're able to order the food or purchase the foods with SNAP dollars that their family will eat. I have two picky teenagers. My kids would not just eat whatever necessarily that came in the box. If they had to, they might, but, you know, they're picky. And so being able to get culturally appropriate foods, things like that. Also, every dollar in SNAP in the state of South Dakota puts $1.80 in revenue into communities. And where that really hits us the hardest is our rural communities. Our rural grocery stores are closing, and we know that we can't afford that. That creates more food deserts, more people who are food insecure, more people who are utilizing services that Pam and I are trying to support. But while we fill the gap, we both are trying to work ourselves out of a job here. We would rather not see the food waste, mm-hmm. not see people who are in our food lines. But in the process, we're filling this gap where I feel like maybe the government's falling short.
How many local rural grocery stores are at risk of closing? Help us understand how widespread that problem is or the vulnerability is.
The number that I heard yesterday was 48 grocery stores are at risk. Now, whether or not that means they would have to shut down their hours more or close completely, but there are 48 vulnerable grocery stores and many on reservations, which is a really big struggle for us. We know that the food desert is even larger. If you've ever been to a reservation, it's pretty we have rural – it's same – mm-hmm. things that we have in our rural communities, very far stretched out, you know, space. But there's not, you know, we bring our food truck out there and it's gravel roads to get to communities and neighbor, you know, there's not big neighborhoods and it's just not designed where it's, you know, a lot of space in between, which is beautiful, but makes it really hard to get
to
food.
Some challenges there. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's next as you look ahead? What are some of the who are you talking to? What are you asking for? We'll start with you, Lori, and figure out, like, as you see, because what I'm hearing you say is this is an organization with a strong history. There's been some immediate challenges to you fiscally this year that have caused you to reduce programs. And yet you're seeing the need go up in some ways that you understand, other ways that you don't understand. You're anticipating greater challenges in the future because of some programs that you're seeing, like perhaps a reduction in SNAP benefits for people. Who are you talking to? What are you asking?
Yeah, so we're talking to our state government. We're talking to the federal government. And then we are privately funded. 99% of our funding comes privately. So we are reaching out to our donors in our community to educate and advocate on behalf of those guests who need the services. But recently I was speaking with Senator Thune's office in D.C. And, you know, we have the ability to effectively and efficiently and safely move food. Our organizations, we are doing it very well, very efficiently. And I mean, for Feeding South Dakota, 93 cents of every dollar goes to the programs. So, I mean, the federal government can't do it as cheap as we do it. Like, we are doing our jobs really well. And I know Pam and her organization is similar. So what we want our legislators to know is that if we are here at the state, so I'll be at the Appropriations Committee in a week at the State Appropriations Committee. When we go there, we don't go there with hands out waiting for the state to bail us out. We don't receive state funding. So mm-hmm. We're there because the federal systems have made cutbacks that are putting us in a difficult situation right now. This is a moment in time. We know that we'll continue to work on programming and continue to get people into, addressing those root causes of poverty so that we can get people out of our food line. But in this moment in time right now, people are hungry and we need food. We need access to food so we can get it to the people who need it. And I know that that's a similar challenge that other nonprofits have. So that's what I'm talking about. When I go to talk to the Appropriations Committee, we need food. So we either need money to purchase food or we need you to work with the USDA to get us food. Whatever way they get there, we'll take the food and we'll move it and we'll make sure that the families who need it get it.
And we hear often from the federal leadership that some of these programs belong in the state government. So going to a state appropriations committee would be a logical next step for you.
Yeah, I think a lot of other states, their states do participate or donate to the local food banks. The food banks are usually the system that get it out. That's pretty common in most states. However, our state doesn't fund our programs. So we mm-hmm. are, the way that we work, I would say, I think we probably have a little bit different thinking in South Dakota that it should be. I think they like that we're privately funded, mm-hmm. right? Because we're running alongside and running this program through the generosity of some amazing philanthropy that we have in the state, which is great. However, we're running state programs. We're running all of the CSFP, which is our senior box program. We're running that whole state program. We're running the entire state. The TFAP, the Emergency Food Assistance Program, currently we run about 75% of that, and we'll likely be taking over the whole 100% of that in the near future. And so those programs are USDA programs. Dollars come from the federal government, mostly through the Farm Bill and or through some of these other funding, come to the state, and then we're running the program. So we should be in partnership with the state. And we are on those programs. But what we are saying is when you make cuts to those programs, we need you to help us supplement that for this moment in time only. Yeah. You know, we don't anticipate that this is going to be the trajectory forever. We hope, and I know Pam and her organization is the same way. We hope that we're making a dent in this food insecurity and the food insecurity rates go down. We're not trying to, you know, I hear this sometimes of, you know, is it a perpetual thing? And food insecurity is situational for many people. Sometimes they use our services once in a year. Sometimes they may be chronic users of it, depending on what their situation is. But it is much more likely at a food bank in our food pantries that we see people once, twice, three times, and then they're back to their job and they're getting back on their feet. So it's a hand up, not a hand out.
Yeah. Pam, the future. What are you asking for? What are you concerned about? What's giving you hope?
Yeah, well, our hope and what is an opportunity is that Bread Break is growing. So going from 300,000 pounds last year of recovered food in the Sioux Falls area to over 400,000 this year. And then ultimately our goal is 1 million pounds per year, which is about 1/15 of what it looks like here in this area. And then branching out to other communities with our model, we have implemented Food Rescue US. It's an app that all of our volunteers are getting used to, sure, and they're starting to use. So we're looking at efficiencies to make that work. It really is a win-win-win for us and food. So food businesses get $1.90 per pound, depending on what it is. They get a tax incentive. We're keeping food out of the landfill and working very closely with the city on that, just to do more ideas together, and then ultimately getting a lot of food to people in need. But looking at the future and trying to, reshape some of the attitudes or understanding of where we could go, we are going to start locally with presenting a resolution on the Bill Emerson Act, which is a federal act that actually allows gleaning, it's called. So it holds people and organizations harmless to actually do it. So as long as you are following the food laws, food preparation laws of the state, that is in place. So we want to educate our city councilors, our county commissioners, and then ultimately take it to the state legislature. So they first of all understand, you know, what Lori and I are talking about today, that agriculture is our number one industry, supporting those ag producers. Number two, people are hungry. And the situations that they're in. So we can have a conversation first. We're not going to change any laws immediately, but we're going to start learning about what we can do to minimize that food waste. So we are not wasting those resources, wasting those dollars. Mm-hmm. So it's bigger than any given one of us, and it is quite complicated. But what it comes down to is that working together and communicating better on all of this to make improvements in the system and then reach more people so they can live out their lives, yeah, and get jobs, get the transportation. One idea that I was thinking that it would be great if our state or city could think about is actually working with businesses that want to build grocery stores that... If there's all of these grocery stores, many of us grew up in small towns in the Midwest, 48 of them at risk of closing or have closed. What are we really going to do? I mean, that should be a priority for our leaders. So I thank you, Lori, for bringing that up. That is huge, you know, to let leadership know on appropriations and maybe bring a map and show where those grocery stores are. What would we do without those?
Do either of you have a personal relationship with food insecurity? Is this something that has you've grown up with, or you've been close to people who've had this as a challenge, Pam?
I would not say that I personally do. Growing up on a family farm was so ideal. We grew a lot of our own food, canned it, and et cetera. But what I will say is that my own daughter, as a part-time student at Augustana and then working part-time, she has utilized SNAP because of to help that situation so she can make that work. She's 25. So that is one. And then my brother, who is 5 years younger than me, suffers from a lot of health issues. Mm. So Medicaid expansion was really helpful to him because Crohn's disease was pretty challenging. We didn't have a diagnosis for a while and almost lost his life a couple times. Mm. But then SNAP kind of has helped him as well. So these programs are there. He works part-time. He actually works at Pomegranate Market, which is wonderful for him.
Which is a partner.
And he gets to be around vegetables and fruits. Yeah, yeah. And a partner of Bread Break. So, you know, with that, I would say, even if you don't have a personal, like it hadn't happened to you, that you haven't gone hungry or food insecure, yes, you always know people, and you should know people, whether they're your relatives, friends, or just people, other community members, that we need to care about each other to help get one another through, because a brighter tomorrow is what we're working for. We want everyone to have that opportunity.
What does a cultural shift look like for food and hunger in South Dakota, Lori? Are there things that you would identify that you would say, okay, this is changing for the better? Because right now what I'm hearing is the problem keeps increasing, and there's more people in your line and there's more working people in your line, and you've had to reduce what they're getting. So this seems like a problem that's worsening to me from our conversation. What would be some of the markers or benchmarks that you would say, okay, yeah, we're getting it. We're getting it. There's a cultural shift going with how we deal with hunger in the state.
I think one of the biggest things we could do is losing the judgment of what food insecurity looks like. I do have a food insecurity story, a slight connection to it. I didn't know. I mean, I wouldn't say we were hungry growing up, but we definitely had food scarcity in our house. Yeah. We moved around a lot. My dad was in the military, and my mom utilized, we got the commodity cheese, you know, we got the blocks of cheese and the commodity bread and things like that. And I didn't know growing up that that was free food, or that my mom had to wait in some line and be subject to judgment in that line. And so I think the one thing that we could do as not just everyone, as neighbors, being good neighbors to each other, is to not judge what food insecurity looks like. It might be that person sitting next to you in church who last month had a medical situation similar to Pam's brother that all of a sudden changed their financial situation. And now they're making difficult decisions between, do I get much needed medication this month, pay my electric bill, or get food? Those are difficult decisions that no one wants to make. We had a family walk into our food pantry, our food bank, the first year I worked here. And it was a father and a mother who were struggling. And when you talk about working families, these were both working parents. And he got a 50-cent raise at his job. And that 50-cent raise put them over the limit to get access to much-needed medical care for their son, who had he is diabetic, and he had a pump. It was $1,500 in services they were receiving every month. He went back to his job and said, can I not get the raise? My son needs this medical care. We can't afford it. And he said, I'm in the food bank because we're in a month where we're trying to get it reallocated. And so they're in the food bank this month. Maybe they won't need to be there next month. But they were trying to make the difficult decision. Do I have my wife stay home? Do I take away my pay? I mean, those are incentivizing the right things. Mm-hmm. So we need to be looking at how do we get programs to step people up, not just, okay, you have a job today, you're right off assistance tomorrow. Let's maybe work them over 6 months to get people. Just because you get a job tomorrow doesn't mean you're able to pay all your bills and you've got a whole cupboard full of food, right? Yeah. So those things, and also, I mean, the no judgment is a big thing. It is a very humbling thing to be in a food line. And I have to say, when I sit in our mobile distributions and I'm putting food in the back of people's cars, it's amazing the stories they'll tell you. The first thing that most people say, though, in South Dakota is, oh, I don't normally need food, but I lost my job last week. They want to immediately give me their reason, yeah, right? Mm-hmm. And I said, it doesn't matter. If I could put no judgment on our T-shirts, and I know Pam would feel the same way, that if we could say there's no judgment, we're here for you, whether you need us one time or several months in a row, that's what I would do. And I would want our neighbors to treat our neighbors the same way too. Yeah. That would be one of the biggest cultural shifts, I think. And if our legislators thought like that, imagine the legislation they might pass to support their neighbors. Yeah. And then organizations like yours, if we can't advocate and educate people on this, then we're not going to get better at this work.
This is the education platform.
Yeah, it is. We need public radio. We need public broadcasting.
Lori Dykstra leads Feeding South Dakota. Pam Cole leads Bread Break. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We have been spending the hour talking about strengthening food systems, food recovery, and ways to address food insecurity in South Dakota. Throughout our state, people are finding ways to connect local growers with the people who eat their food through grocery store partnerships, farmers markets, food pantries, and farm-to-school programs. But I'd like to introduce you now to some farmers In the Moment producer Ari Youngeman and I met recently at Eugene Field Elementary School in Sioux Falls. Ari and I were helping Eugene Field kids make podcasts, Megan and Dan Eisenvoss were helping those same kids make the connection between gardening and sustainable food systems. The Eisenvoss farmers have transformed an acre of land near the Big Sioux River in a residential neighborhood of Sioux Falls into what is now known as Iron Fox Farm.
When Megan and I moved to the neighborhood, we'd often take walks, and we would walk past a vacant lot that was a lot of grass and some large trees, and it was for sale. And for a long time, we thought this would be a wonderful place to grow food. Many months passed, and it was still for sale. And we connected with the seller, who happened to be involved in the profession I am. So we had an in, and we offered what we could for it, and the seller accepted that offer. With the intention, we told them that we wanted to share this space with the community around us, and it just so happened that Eugene Field Elementary was just a block away. And so since then, we've been developing this plot into an urban garden that's a teaching garden, but also provides food for the nearby community.
What in the world made you think, what was in your background, Megan, that you walked by that empty lot and said, I think it should be a farm? This would be a great place to grow food.
Growing food has always been something Dan and I have wanted to do together. And my background's in nutrition, and I've always been really excited about farm to school and how bringing more connections to our youngest people can help instill better eating habits or a better understanding of our food system. So then to be able to take this vacant lot and use it to bring that opportunity to the kids in our neighborhood has been really valuable.
Did you grow up farming?
I did. I grew up on a cattle farm in Turner County.
Okay. Dan, did you grow up farming?
I'm a city boy.
You're a city boy. Okay.
But yeah. I picked strawberries and rhubarb for 3 summers.
And then how did you make a plan? Once you have this idea, now you're in it. And the name, we should say, Iron Fox comes from your names. Give us that story, because I like the naming story behind the farm as well.
Yeah, before our urban farm, before Iron Fox Farm, we already knew if we ever did end up farming, we would name it Iron Fox. And it's a play on our last names. When we were married, we combined our last names to be Eisen Voss, and the translation of that, Eisen, Iron, and Voss, Fox, which is how we came up with that name.
So it's both of you together. Where did you begin? What kind of conversations? Were you mapping things out in the back of napkins at restaurants, or how did it start with the planning?
Well, before we had Iron Fox Farm, we had a pretty substantial garden at my parents' farm, with the intention of growing the food for our wedding. And so that was our first experience together growing food, and we really enjoyed it.
We also have a lot of mentors along the way. So we have really good examples of local growers in and around Sioux Falls, especially Megan's cousins. And we've learned a lot from them about what to do and what not to do. And we still make mistakes all the time and learn from those mistakes. But that was really helpful to have people that had been growing on a small patch of land, but on a large scale for quite some time.
Yeah. Well, how do you adapt it for the fact that it's in a floodplain, that every 30 years or so this might be underwater?
So last year we had that big flood, and our property, the floodwaters came right up to the edge of our garden, but did not get into the garden. And so we're feeling very fortunate there.
We always have to operate on a mentality that whatever we put in this plot of land, we have to make sure that it could not be picked up and brought by floodwaters to plug a culvert or a drainage way, because that would create problems down the line for other people. So whenever we're thinking about trying something new, building anything, we need to have that in the back of our head.
So like pumpkins are out?
Smaller things like that are probably
pumpkins
okay.
Are okay.
Yeah. But in terms of structures.
Structures. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I got it. All right. How do you involve the neighborhood? I do want to know about your wedding. Did you really feed your guests food that you had grown? Was that part of?
That's a whole nother story. We did, actually, on a very... Our wedding ended up a little different than we had envisioned it.
Yeah. It was a bit of COVID era. Yeah.
Oh, okay,
so, so we did feed the people that were there, but it was not as many as we had hoped. And yeah. So we
so
have
you
plans
start
for
this
the
farm in 2021, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you're thinking heavily about food systems at that point as well. I mean, you probably are, always were, but the rest of us were also thinking with the disruption of 2020 of where our food systems were failing.
Mm.
How did the time that you started the farm, that time in history, impact how you considered what the farm could be, Megan?
The COVID era revealed a lot of fragility in our food system. And part of that is the hyper-consolidation of many parts of our food system. The more that we can bring food production closer to the consumer, it becomes more resilient and connected. As far as how it's shaped our farm, we have brought food production in the same block as some of the consumers, many of the consumers of the produce.
Have you made some of those connections with the neighborhood?
In two ways. We have neighbors that have invested in us to receive vegetables in turn. And that's wonderful for them. They get freshly picked vegetables throughout the entire summer. But also just visibility of our neighbors. We always reflect that there's no way we would know as many neighbors that we do if we didn't have this project. People like to stop by. They like to ask us what's going on. They like to comment on things. And it strengthens our relationship with our neighbors, and we feel it really strengthens our neighborhood just to know who's living around you.
How many of those people have farm stories themselves? There are rural people who've moved to the city, and how many are the city kids that say, like, what are you doing? What's that? What's that? What's that?
You know, I don't know how many came from a farm background, but I do know there are a number that have lived in that neighborhood for many, many years, some since the 1960s.
Wow. And some that remember when Cherry Rock Farm was still farming at Cherry Rock Park.
Oh, I didn't know that was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was a farm at some point before it was a park?
The park was part of their original property that, and Laura and Marco could tell you the better story, but at some point it was sold and... Now we just farm a block away.
But learning some of that history of what used to be there. There used to be homes there. There used to be a passenger train that ran through there. There used to be a carnival that would happen right on our block. There used to be fields beyond our block when Sioux Falls was still very young and small.
That's fascinating. All right, tell me about Eugene Field and the partnership with an elementary school.
Working with Eugene Field has been a huge success. When we first got the property, Dan basically cold called Principal Meese and said, we're this couple in the neighborhood. This is our dream. What do you think? Mm-hmm. Our original plan was to work with all the students, and we're very grateful that he weaned us down to just the third and fourth graders. We go into the school a few times in the spring, and the students come to Iron Fox Farm, so it's just a two-block walk, and get to take their transplants and plant them directly into the garden and see that process of seed to transplant. Then in the fall, the students come back as fourth and fifth graders, harvest it all, and then plant a cover crop together. We're trying to instill soil stewardship, stewarding the land, working with nature, working with each other for a collective, productive space to share.
Yeah. Dan, what parts do the students really get into? What are they like and what are they not so keen on?
It's not hard to believe that just finding a worm can be the most exciting activity in the garden. And not every child is into gardening, and that's okay. But we have some students that come up to us later in the year and they say, I started my own garden, or I'd helped my grandma all summer long, and we picked all these different things. And to give them the encouragement or the nudge to realize that they can grow their own food, whatever they want. They can do farming on a very small scale. They can provide fresh produce for their families. If we can just convince a few of those students that that's something they're capable of, then we feel successful in our endeavor.
Yeah. How can places like this, endeavors like this, impact the food system? That's a big question.
There is a lot of underutilized land in cities that could be transformed to really be positive components of neighborhoods. Like Dan mentioned, we really feel this has been a positive thing for our little pocket of people building relationships and having this value add in our neighborhood. As far as how it could impact food systems, that exposure is a really small thing, but can be really powerful. The more that we get to be part of the power of a seed that can grow hundreds of pounds of squash is a beautiful miracle that could be one positive impact to people that helps us rethink the food that we're purchasing and eating.
Yeah, that educational component, Dan, that's huge.
Yeah, and to pivot a little bit, I think about how we are very front and center, like something you can drive to within a few minutes and you can see. But there are many small local producers that may be an hour away or 2 hours away, and they're doing things in a similar way to us. We're not mirroring them exactly, but we're hoping to encourage, you know, you get to know your grower, and then you have local growers in South Dakota who are working really hard to provide an excellent product. And if you can support them, you should do that in any way you possibly can.
Yeah. When we're talking about food insecurity or scarcity, hunger, this is also a neighborhood with a pretty high percentage of, you know, free and reduced lunches at that school. Many of these kids, you know, food is not a given every single night. How might that impact their lives, the work that you're doing with them in the school?
I think directly what we're doing, probably not much. You know, we're at the end in the fall when they come harvest, they're getting a bag of vegetables to bring home that maybe will last them for a meal or two or something like that. Sure. And nutritionally, you know, it's not like they're getting protein and fats and things like that. But what I will say is if they're turned on by it, if they want to garden, if they want to grow something, they become a little more self-sustaining. And in a food insecure environment where food prices continue to rise, where we have insecurity about the demand and the supply of things in the grocery store, they can take a little more control of that as they get older. And not just students, but anybody. I mean, you can grow a lot of food in a small amount of space.
Megan and Dan Eisenvoss grow vegetables and flowers at Iron Fox Farm. It's in a residential neighborhood near the Big Sioux River in Sioux Falls. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngman, Ellen Kester, and me. I'm Lori Walsh. From all of us here at SDPB, thank you for listening.